Good morning, everyone. Two is company, but 12 or 10 to 11 is a crowd. And our purpose for being present this morning is to spread Groencast the teachings of Theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. And please note this wonderful little pamphlet that you can pick up at the desk, book table, or from the usher's table before you leave, if this is your first visit. And as we just explained our purpose, we will let you know what the policy of this lodge is. And it's called Independent Devotion to the Cause of Theosophy. Without professing attachment to any theosophical organization, it is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave at the time of inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is a dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy, and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. Therefore, has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race or creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. And as you will certainly know inside, we're all supported by volunteer contributions, choice of each individual on its own. This is Sunday, November the 4th, and our talk will be under the title of Practical Theosophical Ideas, Universal Unity and Interdependence. Wednesdays, the doors open at 5:15 to allow you a couple hours in our library. It's a Theosophical Reference Library, and it's free for use. And you may ask the librarian any question you wish to ask concerning our studies, etc. Meeting, or called a study class, begins promptly at 7:30, but you have 15 minutes after the library. 7:30 to 8:30 p.m., and at the present time where our studies are in The Ocean of Theosophy, a wonderful little book by William Q. Judge. Everybody is welcome. And as we said, if we missed anything, pick up one of these before you leave. And it's a custom here to begin our talk this morning with a reading. And the book chosen this time to read from is called the Bhagavad Gita, famous little book that you can see on the book table. to wit, devotion through knowledge of the Supreme Spirit. Men say that the Ashtavatthi tree, the eternal sacred tree, grows with its roots above and its branches below, and the leaves of which are the Vedas. He who knows this knows the Vedas. Its branches growing out of the three qualities, with the objects of sense as the lesser shoots, spread forth, some above, some below. And those rich roots which ramify below in the regions of mankind are the connecting bonds of action. Its form is not thus understood by men. It has no beginning, nor can its present constitution be understood, nor has it any end. When one has hewn down with the strong axe of dispassion this Ashtavatthi tree with its deeply embedded roots, then that place is to be sought after from which those who there take refuge nevermore return to rebirth. For it is the primeval spirit from which floweth the never-ending stream of conditioned existence. Those who are free from pride, of self, and whose discrimination is perfected, who have prevailed over the fault of attachment to action, who are constantly employed in the devotion to meditation upon the Supreme Spirit, who have renounced desire and are free from the influence of the opposites known as pleasure and pain, are undiluted and proceed to that place which endureth forever. Neither the sun nor the moon nor the fire enlighteneth that place. From it there is no return. It is my supreme abode. We invite you to listen.
Before we begin, we wanted to mention that the original presentation this morning was a panel. Unfortunately, one of the panelists is unable to present this morning. Nevertheless, had very interesting ideas on the subject, which have been incorporated into this talk this morning. So we are beginning in November a new umbrella theme: practical theosophical ideas. Another word for that are, other words for that are the fundamental principles of theosophy. So we might begin our talk this morning just understanding what we mean by a theosophical principle. Theosophical principles then are universal bases for thought and action. Therefore, they are inherently practical in the way we think, speak, act towards one another and towards nature. They are considered universal ideas because they transcend limited time, space, and even peoples. So these are timeless ideas that were true in the past, they are true and relevant today, and they will be continuously practical in the future. They are found in all nations and civilizations, Eastern and Western, ancient and modern. They are found in science, religion, philosophy. So they are indeed universal. They are also universal in the sense that they are expressions of the accumulated wisdom of the ages. They do not belong to any one particular nation or race. They are not the revelation of one particular person. And they are ideas that we, as said, can be applied to all sorts of particular situations. And the fundamental, the basic universal principle upon which all the other principles are based or are applications of, is the idea of unity and interdependence being a fact in nature and the basis for universal brotherhood and ethical behavior. This idea of universal unity and interdependence, therefore, can be found in all philosophies, sciences, and religions, and in all civilizations. If we look into these ancient civilizations, Eastern and Western, we see that the idea of universal unity and interdependence has been preserved as a living truth in the symbolism of these peoples. And these symbols are found in all the ancient civilizations and pretty much mean the same thing. These symbols are expressions of ideas. And when we think of universal unity and interdependence, when we first hear it, it still sounds kind of abstract, even though it is a noble thought. And so we want to begin by bringing it down to words that may have more meaningful relevance to us. So when we associate ideas with the universal unity and interdependence, we think of balance and harmony. We think of connection. We think of reciprocity. One person or being helping another and being helped in turn. We think of kinship or family, how the parents help the young, and how the young in turn help their siblings and the parents in time. We think of the remarkable diversity and unity in life. We also think of the mutual responsibility and respect and gratitude one might show for another. These are all more graspable ideas when we think of universal unity and interdependence. And what is interesting, the symbols that come down to us represent or preserve these ideas as lessons for the people of the time and for us today. In fact, the symbols that we're going to begin to talk about in the first part of this lecture have become sacred to different groups because of a general understanding of their meaning. So we're going to talk about three symbols to start with: the egg, the six-pointed star, and the tree. Now, the egg, or the circle, is a symbol that is found throughout all the different religions. We know of the Easter eggs, of course. And it is a suitable symbol to represent the source of all and the origin of all being, the idea that everything comes from one source. Because when you think about it, pretty much every living being comes from an egg, a germ, a seed, and manifests. It's also a symbol of the universe in total, because we have the outer shell, we might say represented physical life. We have the inner yolk and albumen representing the soul, the fluidic, we might say the astral part. And of course, we have the life germ developing within it, the being, the spiritual being. So in that egg, we have represented the totality of life. And it is a symbol in these different traditions of immortal, eternal life, the constant regeneration and generation of life from within outward. And when we think of it, it's a mystery. From this egg, in a certain amount of time, comes forth silently with no apparent intervention, a being which lives, develops, and reproduces itself through other eggs or seeds. A wonderful symbol of the unity and origin of life. We also have the idea of the six-pointed star, the double triangle. Now, depending on our tradition, we may know it as Solomon's seal, the Star of David, the sign of Vishnu, the Sri Antara of the Brahmins, but this symbol is found throughout the world. And as you know, it is a double, interlaced double triangles. So there are, in fact, six compartments and then a central one. And it is a beautiful symbol of the six dimensions of space. So it incorporates all, up, down, east, west, north, south. It represents all of manifested life, but also represents through the upward triangle, the spiritual, the lower triangle, the material, and where they meet, the synthesis, which is in the human being, as above, so below. A wonderful symbol seen throughout the tradition of the unity of life, the interconnected, the interlocking of life, the spiritual and the material. We also see the tree. Now we know from the tradition of the Garden of Eden, we have the idea of the tree of life and the tree of knowledge. We've heard this morning in the Bhagavad Gita about the Agnishvata tree, a tree that grows with its roots in heaven and its descending, diversifying branches on the material plane. And of course, there is in the northern Scandinavian tree, the world tree, the Yggdrasil. And of course, as we know, coming up, the Christmas tree. So these ideas of the diversity of life represented by the branches, all coming from one trunk or unity, has always been a wonderful symbol of the unity and interdependence of life. So these are ideas that have come down to us through the ages about the unity of life. And what we need to do is check, test, and verify it to see if it's a basis by which we can think and act. This idea of universal unity and the interdependence of life. And there's two basic ways we can do it. We can do it as a scientist and proceed from particulars to universals. And that can be a very helpful way, because we have to begin with where we are, what we see and observe, the particulars, and draw general conclusions. Or we can begin from the point of view of a philosopher and look at universal principles which are in harmony with those facts, and then apply them to all the particular aspects of our life. It's very interesting to understand ecology or the interdependence of the various life cycles as particulars, but that doesn't help you in your relationship to other human beings, in your relationship to nature, unless you begin with universal principles that can be applied in any one situation. So we need both. So for the remainder of our talk this morning, we're going to use part of it to go from particulars to universals, and in the second part, we're going to go from universals to particulars in understanding this idea. And we've chosen to go from particulars to universals, the lessons of universal unity and interdependence that are taught to us by nature, by the tree. Now, we remember from our reading in the Bhagavad Gita, the sacredness and symbolism of the tree. And we've reviewed some of that in other traditions. But we might really think of the tree as a giving tree. The tree shares a unique and intimate relationship with humanity. It is the one species in all the kingdoms of nature that gives humanity food, water, oxygen, clothing, medicine, protection from heat and cold, and the products that we use every day in our life. And we might add, it also gives us spiritual comfort and nourishment. Just think of the idea of the inspiration of the Christmas tree, of the tree in the Garden of Eden, of the trees, the sacred trees in the different traditions, the Bodhi tree, the Banyan tree in the East, all of these ideas being inspiring in that way. But the tree is actually intimately related to other trees, kingdoms of nature, and cannot exist in isolation from other trees, plants, and beings. Like humanity, its unity and interdependence is not obvious on the surface, but is literally hidden from view. So we take this idea of connectedness, connection, or what is called in science symbiosis, species or individuals existing interdependent on one another. So trees are connected to trees of the same species, other species, and the little seedlings that develop them through an underground network of fungi. And these fungi connect with the roots of the trees and exchange water and nutrients in turn for carbon. Now, what do we say? That something by itself is weak, but in unity with one and others, they gain strength. Unity is a source of strength. And we see this among the trees. This underground connection of one tree to its seedlings, for example, leads to resilience and strength. Seedlings form associations with older trees through this underground network in 3 months. And those seedlings that make the connections with their elder trees are 4 times more likely to survive than those that don't. So we see resilience coming from unity. But also we see the idea of kinship or family demonstrated in the trees. And we could even use the term of the mother tree that has, through this underground connections of fungi, connections with younger trees, its seedlings. So if you can imagine in a forest, you have these old trees and periodically they drop off little seeds and seedlings which grow around them into other trees, But there are other big trees in the forest nearby, and they have their own seedlings. But what's interesting here is even though they're all interconnected with these different mother trees, they're all interconnected underground with these fungi, the mother trees send nutrients preferentially to their seedlings. That means that they can recognize, quote, those seedlings that have developed from themselves. And one can trace the amount of nutrients and carbon that flows from the mother tree and see that more of it winds up in their seedlings than in others. So their seedlings grow stronger and faster than the others. So we see a kind of kinship in that kingdom. But there's more. We also see, we talked about reciprocity, how one helps another in need, provides the strong, provide for the weak, and the weak in turn are benefited by the strong. And sometimes in an association, in unity and interdependence, what we're weak in one area, we're strong in another, and we can return the favor to another. That's an example of interdependence. But we see that among trees as well. So we have a forest, and growing in that forest in close proximity are two species. We have a species of paper birch, which has leaves, and we have a species of Douglas fir, an evergreen, which grows much taller. And they're connected by this, their roots are connected by this underground system of fungi, the sort of nerves. And what's interesting is in those seasons where the birch has lost its leaves, more nutrients flow from the firs to the birch than the other way. And in another season, when the birch has beautiful leaves and has lots of nutrients, and the fir is sort of subdued, more nutrients flow from the birch into the fir. So we see a reciprocity there, but it goes on. We see protection and mutual respect and responsibility. So let's say that we have a tree and it's stressed, maybe through an insect invasion. It releases certain chemicals through its root system to other trees, and those chemicals stimulate the production in the other trees of certain enzymes, which now makes them resistant to the invading pest. So trees have a way of, through their interconnectedness, of protecting themselves. Now, we might even go so far as to say that trees in their own way, because of this interdependence, can communicate, exchange. But their alphabet, their means of communication is different. It is a chemical language made up of nitrogen, carbon, phosphorus, water, defense signals, hormones, chemicals, through this network. And when we think about it, the tissues may differ, but that's pretty much way the stomach communicates with the brain, or the brain communicates with the muscles or the eyes. It's through a network transmitting different chemical signals. And so we see the same thing. The lesson there is that if we take any particular situation, we chose trees to make a point, but we can look at the other kingdoms of nature and see that interdependence and unity is a fact in nature. Universal brotherhood, interdependence, unity is a fact in nature. In fact, the isolated tree could not continue to exist any more than a human being couldn't continue to exist if it wasn't for this underground connection between the individuals. And in the same way, we are connected in this, although on the surface, as human beings, we seem to be separate. So now we're going to go the other way, from universals to particulars, keeping in mind the lesson we learned as natural scientists. So, in the philosophy, and we'll see more of this as we go along, there are fundamental principles, bases by which we can think universally. And they are self-proving, just as we can go out into nature and prove to ourselves certain scientific facts. We can take these ideas and test and check and see if they have application and value and meaning and usefulness in every particular aspect of our life and see if they make sense to us. No one's asked to accept them on their face value, but to check, test, and verify. And the first fundamental is that of the source of life, which we call the deific principle. And this is something that's infinite, never-ending, never-beginning. And so it's very difficult, if not impossible, to grasp a single idea, a finite idea with our minds that can incorporate the whole. Now, in attempting to do this, we come up with the God idea, an image, an anthropomorphic image, something that's less than this universal, because it helps us make a connection in our mind. But in truth, that which is the source of all cannot be limited, like a being is limited. And perhaps we've said this from time to time, the closest idea we can come up to is the infinitude of space. But even space, I mean, we can only go so far in imagining the infinite extension of space. But we understand that space has no attributes, yet it's the source of all. Deity is like that. It cannot be less than space. And from deity, this one universal whole, everything comes forth. It is the, quote, spiritual basis of all. But everything comes forth in a plan. And we can see this plan throughout nature. It's called the sevenfold plan. So as above, so below. Just as there are seven aspects to humanity, or seven principles of the human being, there are seven principles of this planet, of the solar system, of all the kingdoms. And so there's a correspondence, an interconnectedness between each of the seven. We might say, there are seven colors of the solar spectrum that we can see. There are seven notes on the scale. And there is an interdependence, an interrelationship between these all and ourselves. So that is one way in which this first fundamental, these are a few ways in which the first fundamental teaches us about the unity of life. One source, one manifesting plan or process. And we begin to use that to understand our interdependence with others. Another way is that realizing that all are subject to law. And that fundamental law in the East is called karma. But we also understand it as action and reaction. But action and reaction are only the manifestations of karma. What we can see, we can observe an act and we can observe the reaction, but what is it that brings it about? What is it that lawfully brings the result of every action back to the point of the individual who set it up? And that is this fundamental balance and harmony that exists in nature. And whenever it's disturbed, that fundamental harmony is disturbed, the universe itself brings it back into a state of balance. So you drop a pebble into a pond or into a pail of water, and the ripples go out, the disturbance goes out, eventually it all settles down. That is a small example of the process of karma, the restoring of harmony where it's been disturbed in great nature. We feel that as cause and effect, and as human beings, we feel it as pleasure and pain, and as a result, we make changes, hopefully. Another way in which we see law operating are cycles. Now, we know that cycles apply to all situations, but we are interdependent. We are united through this law of cycles. We have a cycle of waking and sleeping as human beings, and within a certain degree, we all have periods of wakefulness and sleeping around the same time. And so we work together in communities to thrive based on this law of cycles. There are certain times when we wake and we sleep and we're productive and we eat. We depend on this cooperation of cycles to exist and get things done. There's an interdependence. But there are also cycles in nature. We breathe in and out. It occurs so many times a minute. But we also, within that period of time, have a certain heartbeat that occurs. Without the two cycles occurring together in harmony, the body could not exist. So there are cycles within cycles. We see them in the seasons of the year, in all the different departments of nature. And the more we understand these cycles and how they affect one another, the more links and connections we see. This becomes very practical in how we live our lives. We can do certain things in harmony with the cycle of our nature and get better results than if we function in opposition to these cycles. A third way in which we can apply this law of the law of the universe of cycles is that of re-embodiment. And when we think about it, everything that exists as a form is the re-embodiment, the re-expression of something or some essence or material that's existed before. All the kingdoms of nature, including the human being, are the re-expression, the re-embodiment of pre-existing substance. Even on the physical plane, we all come from the same stuff. And the atoms and the electrons that make up the mineral kingdom are pretty much the same that make up the human kingdom. Their correlations, their correspondences, their cycles, their interactions are different, but the stuff is the same. It's the re-embodiment of the same material. So these ideas, these universal ideas of harmony and balance, of cycles, of embodiment, re-embodiment, or reincarnation, can be applied for us to better understand the unity and interdependence of life. The last idea we want to mention is that of evolution. All things evolve through their interaction with one another. As human beings, because we are self-conscious thinkers, we have a great influence on the kingdoms below us. Part of the reason is we incorporate into our nature the mineral, the vegetable, the animal kingdom. They go up to make the human being we are, at least part of the human being we are. As we think and feel and choose, the impression of our thought and action raises up or retards that progress. As we raise up or retard the lower kingdoms, they in return react on us and can encourage or retard our progress spiritually and intellectually as thinkers. So we see this tremendous interaction, this interdependence and unity in evolution all around us. And all the natural scientists, when they study the evolution of kingdoms in nature, they see how as one species evolves, it doesn't evolve independently from others. Its evolution has an effect on the entire community in which it lives. And a mutation, a variation in one species can have tremendous effect on the evolution of the other species in the kingdom. So this morning we've tried to look at this idea of universal unity and interdependence from different perspectives. We looked at it from the point of view of the universality of symbols. We've looked at it from a point of view of natural scientists, beginning from particulars and going to universals. And finally, we've looked at it from the point of view of a philosopher, a thinker, beginning with universal principles and seeing their practical application in understanding and applying this idea of the unity and interdependence of life. Now, we're sure you have many questions and observations from your own experience, so we invite you to contribute questions or comments at this time. Yes?
Well, during the whole course of this idea of unity, the first group that we think of beside the human kingdom is the animal kingdom. Look at all the interconnections of different animals at certain times, and then those that are ones that work in herds that look after each other, and then that idea fascinates us that other species will interplay and help with certain things. It's really, when you think about it, it is fascinating.
Yeah. So, yes, the interplay of different species, how the life cycle of certain insects and animals, their life cycle actually helps preserve the tree or helps in the production of the tree. The tree decays, the logs fall down, they rot, and yet those holes in the logs become the homes of all sorts of animals which thrive. In turn, they produce things which help and benefit the tree itself becoming a habitat for the diversity of animal and insect life in nature. It's a very fine balance and interdependence that we see. And you don't have to be a country dweller. We can see it in our backyard in the city, or even in a little planter or terrarium that we might enjoy. But throughout it always hits us when we get close to nature of the interdependence. So we wonder then, what is it that gets in the way? Why do we have so much difficulty of taking that lesson and applying it in our everyday lives and how we act towards nature and act towards other individuals? Any other ideas or questions? Yes.
For many, it could be fear of independence. Fear of independence, okay. Since we're so engrossed with our personality. Whereas in the animal kingdom, they don't have that problem.
Yes. Well, yes, the whole idea of fear of independence comes from a human recognition that we are individual thinkers. We are individual beings. Our problem is that we identify with that which is limited in our nature, our personalities, our physical forms, and think of ourselves as separate human beings. And it is that separateness that very often gives rise to the fear, the doubt. Not only about ourselves, but about others. And so, as was pointed out, the intelligence in the lower kingdoms is more collective, communal, if we want to put it that way. And so there is no fear as we understand it as human beings. Yes?
Well, in this collective intelligence that we're all immersed in, what is it with the human kingdom that has divided us from nature? Mm-hmm. What's the attitude that we've developed? Mm-hmm.
So what is it that divides us? Well, once again, we can go from particulars to universals, but that will only help us understand the particular life, the diversified life, in a limited way. What really separates ourselves is a lack of knowledge of who and what we are as human beings, essentially, and the ideas we hold. So if, as said, our ideas are separative, particular, so will be our actions. That's the importance of recognizing and studying and proving to ourselves the validity of universal ideas. The ideas that we're all interconnected through this oneness, this deific principle, that spiritually, in our spiritual essence, we are one with it and therefore connected with everything on the spiritual plane and everything on the material plane. Just as deity pervades all, we are interconnected with all. If we think from that basis, we'll act differently. The idea of karma, reincarnation, cycles. If we believe we are beings of one short life, if we believe that we can act, and as long as the results are not detected or known to somebody else, we get away with it, or there's no responsibility for it, we're going to act in a certain way. If we believe that our evolution is only physical, then we will neglect the growth and expansion of a great part of our nature, the mental, the psychic, the spiritual dimensions, which are much more varied and important than the physical ones. So all these things are reasons why we behave the way we do. So the theosophical education is not to neglect the particulars, but to see them in light of universals, not to neglect the physical nature that is obvious to us from our senses, but also to observe those aspects of nature, we might say nature that is hidden from our senses, but is very well known and appreciated by our thought, our powers of thought, observation, discrimination, feeling, all these inner powers which are good means of gathering knowledge and understanding. Yes?
Yes. So I understand like the symbols in theosophy and in regards to nature and cycle, right? I understand where you're coming from. But it seems to me there's a part of karma and all that that is moral. So when you talk about nature, certain things happen in nature and you understand, and this happens, this cycle happens, this indicates this. Where does like the morality come into it?
Good question. Morality enters once we have a choice. We might say in the lower kingdoms, the issue is not whether it's good or bad, good or evil. It's just the natural response from within, a natural impulse. But that impulse is guided by laws of nature. And the laws of nature, being one of harmony, adjust accordingly. So there is a natural balance and response in the lower kingdoms. We see it manifested in the mineral, vegetable, animal kingdoms to a different degree. We call it instinctive intelligence in the animal kingdom. We call it sensation or sensitivity in the plant kingdom. The same plant will wiggle and turn this way when the sun's this side, and will wiggle and turn the other way when the sun's the other way. It will find water. Its roots will go out and find water. You can even construct a maze and put water and food in one part of the maze and a plant in another way, and the plant will move its roots around that maze until it finds the water. And of course, in the mineral kingdom, we see differential attraction and repulsion. In the human kingdom, though, we see moral intelligence. And that moral intelligence, and therefore the moral responsibility of karma, comes in because as thinkers, we can see the higher, the better. We can see the dearer. We can be self-conscious, aware of ourselves as the individual who can choose one from the other. We can self-consciously and willingly choose to follow our higher aspirations or to give in and follow our lower passions and desires and temptations. We will do as human beings, believing it is our right and our pleasure, destructive things that no animal being would ever do. They are internally repulsed by it, and yet will engage in it without any thought of the consequences, because we are primarily guided by our thinking, our self-conscious choices. That's where the morality of karma comes in. We act and we receive the results of our actions, and we feel it, we suffer or enjoy from it, we experience pleasure and pain from it, because we self-consciously chose to act in a certain direction. As it says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. As a man sows, that shall he reap. All the basis of our morality and ethics worldwide are based on this recognition that we have the ability to choose, but how we choose to act, we will morally feel the consequences of. It's still karma. It's still action and reaction, but it's acting on the plane of mind, of feeling and sensitivity, rather than in nature. The lower kingdoms are not morally responsible, but they do feel the results of our actions nevertheless. Yes?
Well, you just answered my question. But I was going to say, so based on what you were saying, I was thinking that in that regard, morality is related to self-awareness and empathy as well. And you were saying that the lower kingdoms don't have the responsibility of moral intelligence. They don't have that ability, and they are also lacking that self-awareness that human intelligence inherently has. So then we are the moral sectors or the guiders of nature.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, we can certainly learn moral lessons from nature, but we have to recognize them as being natural truths. We might say that when the drafters of our Declaration of Independence drew up those moral principles which guide our government and supposed to guide our laws and the conduct of our lives, they based it on nature's laws, the natural laws that they observed. This grew up at a time when philosophy and science was very much in tune with nature and recognized certain principles as being truths, inalienable truths. But it is, even though we learn from nature, nature is not morally responsible. We are responsible, and as we act, we suffer, but so does nature. We make benefit, but so does nature. And nature reacts back on us in accordance with the impression we give it. We see this. We're becoming more aware of it in our modern times as we become more aware through science and other means that human action is very much able to disturb the balance that exists in nature. Yes?
So then, going back to Genesis, would that
Yes. Well, that's what the story tells us, that once Adam ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, he knew he had done the wrong thing. It says he became ashamed of his nakedness. And because of his opposition, defiance, disobeying, he was expelled from the Garden of Eden, and from now on would suffer disease and illness and all the things worked by the sweat of his brow. And Eve would say to bring forth children, childbirth in pain. Well, that's the moral lesson of that story. But what that tells us philosophically is, once we as human beings develop the capacity of mind, self-consciousness, awareness, once we evolve from being a senseless, mindless animal being to that of a self-conscious human being, our responsibility, our awareness of our condition can never go back. We cannot go back to ignorance. We're aware. We're either aware through feelings of guilt, of shame, of knowing we did the wrong thing, of suffering from the consequences. So this has been taken in several traditions to refer to original sin and so forth. But the whole idea is that, from a theosophical point of view, is, as was stated, self-awareness, self-consciousness is a tremendous gift. It makes us able to do things that the other beings in the different departments of nature cannot do. It gives us knowledge of who and what we are, of right and wrong, of morality. And this knowledge is universal, extends across all traditions. It's the basis of our ethics. But at the same time, it makes us infinitely more powerful and responsibility. It gives us infinitely more power and responsibility for the effects of our actions. Human beings can do more harm in a shorter period of time, or more good in a shorter period of time, than any other kingdom. We'll finish with another thought. Yes?
Well, remember, I think that I should never see a poem as lovely as a tree. And also, could you explain to us those parts of the tree which we can apply to everything that we come in contact with here on this earth? Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't want to go into that completely, but let's say when we go out and we observe the trees around us, to be more aware that they are not isolated beings, no more than we are isolated human beings. That underground, they're connected by a vast network. Beneath each step we take in the forest or ground, there are hundreds of miles of these filaments, of these fungus intertwined together. There is much more connectivity underground that we don't see between the trees, and how vital that is to their survival and their unity and their interdependence. We can take that lesson, and now as we approach and we see other human trees, other human beings with their roots in the heavens and their trunks and branches on the earth, remember that we and they are not isolated beings, but that our unity and interdependence and survival is behind the scenes, is invisible to the senses, is deeper than we might otherwise assume. And to begin to look for those roots and extensions, those similarities, rather than pay attention to all the differences. Just as we neglect trees or any other aspect of nature and misuse them through a misunderstanding, we can harm our fellow human beings through misunderstanding. But we can also help each other through wisdom. So we'll close here and invite you next week. We are continuing this overarching subject of theosophical ideas with that of reincarnation, re-embodiment, the doctrine, the foundation of hope. Our meeting's adjourned.